Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is something deliciously exotic about time spent in another country, abandoning your senses to the smells of local food, the sounds of birds, even traffic. And of course, there's the allure of the foreign language, the effort to be understood. Ever watch what happens when all attempts at communication fail? It might be a taxi driver in Prague or a street vendor in Kuala Lumpur. And often when we don't get through, we just talk louder, because if the guy's not getting it, he'll eventually understand the English. Well, thank goodness for translators. Not only are they our travel guides, but at the height of their art, they are our literary guides as well. Without them, there would be no war and peace, no 100 years of solitude. But help me with the list here. If you scan the shelves of the library or the bookstore, for every 1,000 books published in the U.S. each year, you'll find perhaps 3 works in translation. Now, champions of translation charge the United States for being just as isolationist in its literature as the country is in foreign policy and trade. They'll say that America needs to adjust its literary vision outward. Well, Connection listeners, we are continuing our series on world literature with a homeland perspective. Does America live in a literary bubble? More to the point, with our scales between English language and world literature as unbalanced, what are readers missing? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio today is Ilan Stavins, writer, translator, professor of Latin American and Latino cultures at Amherst College. His most recent book is the memoir On Borrowed Words. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
Ilan, do you spend time in a bookstore or a library scanning the titles that are there and wondering or knowing how many are homegrown and how many come from abroad?
Too much, perhaps, Dick. Many of my hours are reading books and finding those books in libraries and in bookstores. And to my dismay, you're absolutely right. The amount of books that come from abroad into English is getting smaller and smaller, and that means that we're getting more and more parochial.
Do you know why that's happening?
It might have to do with the end of the Cold War, perhaps. We have become the ultimate superpower, and we think other people have to pay homage to us. We shouldn't pay attention to what is happening in their lands. It might also have to do with the fact that Americans are so allergic to foreign languages. We have tons and tons of cinemas, and how many in this country, how many theaters show foreign films? We grow uncomfortable and impatient with subtitles. Whenever somebody is using another language, we're thinking they are un-American. They are not like us. They should be speaking the language that we speak. And so perhaps all those factors have add up to the fact that we read only our literature or only what is digested and easily malleable.
Isn't it also the case that sometimes we'd pick up a book in a bookstore or in a library and not even know that it's a translation, that the success in publishing it in America is not to say this book has been translated by, but simply to say, here's the title, here's the author, and here's the English.
Yeah, there are 2 ways to approach translation. One is to do exactly what you're saying. Let's forget this is a translation. Let's present it in such a pure, crystalline way that it reads as if it was in an original, and it reads as if it was coming from the neighbor next door. The other approach is to emphasize the fact that it is foreign. Let us say the translators that are doing this, that this is not like us, that the language is twisted, that is different, that behaves in forms and fashions unlike ours, and we should never as readers forget that. I think there's a triumph to be made in both approaches, in the approach that emphasizes the artificiality of translation, and the one that suggests that translation is a form of originals.
So do you think that we are in part justly afraid of translation, looking at it as something lesser than the original?
No, we should never be afraid of a translation. We should create a culture in which we are more and more in need and attracted to texts that come from other parts of the world and that are not in our language. If we are to remain this superpower, it will have to be by looking at what others are thinking and are doing and are dreaming. And translation is the only way we can do it. Imagine a world, just for a second, Dick, a world where translators would not exist. We wouldn't have the Bible. We wouldn't have much of what takes place in the United Nations. We wouldn't have the kind of food that we eat every day. Translators are really our heroes. They bring other cultures to us. Very often their names don't even appear on the cover of a book or even in a title page. And yet, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have the book that we're holding in our hands, or we wouldn't have the movie, or we wouldn't have the dialogue between an Afghani and an American politician. It is the translator that creates a bridge between those two.
And how are we to understand what's happening in the translation world right now? In an earlier program, we talked with Raja Alem, a woman in Saudi Arabia, who, giving up on the idea of delivering an Arabic text to someone, laboriously translated it into English, gave it to another writer speaking English, saying, can you turn this into something literary? Is the translator himself or herself also a writer, or is it more still slightly more technical function?
We tend to think very mechanically that translators do nothing else but put a language that is foreign to us into our own in order to be able to be understood. The fact is, translators are as important in the process of creation as the author himself or herself. There are cases, think of the Arabian Nights, where translators have even dared to add a chapter or a character into an original text. There have always also been cases in which the translator has improved a text. You mentioned at the very beginning 100 Years of Solitude. Gabriel Garcia Marquez from Colombia, a Nobel Prize winner, thinks to this day that the English translation by Gregory Rabassa is superior to the original. In other words, that thanks to Rabassa, he got that Nobel Prize, or he got the amount of readers that he has in the English-speaking world. Of course, you can have it the other way around. The translator destroys the original, and we will need another translator to come in and fix what the mess that was left. But either way, the translator will have to do more than simply exchange one word for another. He will have, or she will have, to reinvent the entire text. Just think of this. In Spanish, we have a single word for anger, whereas in English, we have to be angry and to be upset. I remember when my little kid, now 11, was a baby, I would tell my wife, está enojado, he's angry. And she would tell me, no, he's upset, he's not angry. The difference was semantic. It was a matter of words. And yet, I think there were two cultures colliding in that expression. The difference between saying anger as an expression of outward fury, and the one that has more to do with a reaction to the circumstance or to the situation in which you find. If an author comes across a word, anger, in a text, what will she or he choose when it comes from the Spanish? One or the other. That choice, in and of itself, makes translation an art.
Let's turn to something that has been translated. This is the Gimple the Fool. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit of the history. This was originally written by Singer in Yiddish, is that right?
This is a short story, probably the best short story by Isaac Bashevi Singer, the Yiddish writer, Gimple Tam in Yiddish. It was translated in 1953 by another giant of Jewish literature, Saul Bellow, and published for the first time in Partisan Review. And it really is the moment in which Singer leaves the ghetto of his Yiddish language, where only Yiddish readers could read him, and opens up to the rest of the world through English. And this is the way Saul Bellow's version of Gimple the Fool reads. I am Gimple the Fool. I don't think myself a fool. On the contrary, but that's what folks call me. They gave me the name while I was still in school. I had 7 names in all. Imbecile, Donkey, Flaxhead, Dopey, Glump, Ninny, and Fool. The last name stuck. What did my foolishness consist of? I was easy to take in. They said, Gimple, you know the rabbi's wife has been brought to childbed? So I skipped school. Well, it turned out to be a lie. How was I supposed to know? She hadn't had a big belly, but I never looked at her belly. Was that really so foolish? The gang laughed and stomped and danced and chanted a goodnight prayer. And instead of the raisins they give when a woman's lying in, they stuffed my head full of goat turds. I was no walking. If I slapped someone, he'd see all the way to Krakow. But I'm really not a slugger by nature. I think of myself, let it pass, so they take advantage of me.
And this is something different from what was produced in Yiddish.
Very different. The Yiddish has a different feel, has a different texture. As a reader, one reacts to it by invoking an entire universe of shtetls in Eastern Europe. When you read it in English, you are automatically getting to that universe through a veil, so to speak. There was a famous Hebrew poet who used to say that reading a text through translation is like kissing a bride through a veil. The experience of the kiss is right there, but somehow the contact is not quite direct. And Cervantes used to think that to read a text in translation was like looking at a Turkish carpet from the back. The colors are there again, but the patterns have disappeared.
Right.
And I think in that sense, we are looking at a process that brings loss, but it also brings much that is gained.
Didn't you at one point say that translation can be simply like looking at an image of ourselves in a distorted mirror?
Yes. And I think nonetheless, we have an image, and we could perhaps take it from there and believe that every image that we have from ourselves is distorted, that every mirror will present a particular approach depending on the light, depending on the room. We can't live without translation, even if translation is never complete, even if translation can never give us the fullness of the original text. It cannot, at the very least, make us think about what that text is all about, and make us realize that there are cultures out there that are unlike our own, and ours is not supreme, superb, on top of others. It is at the very equal to them.
What did Singer think of that translation, do you know?
Singer had a very strange approach to translators. At the very beginning, he disliked them. He believed that they would destroy the beauty of his text. And just after Bello accomplished this, he realized that without translation, without translators, he was really a nobody. It was thanks to them that he could reach that other reader that was waiting.
And that's more than just a marketing thing. That's more than just selling more books.
That's like a marriage. That's like a relationship that is established forever. And in fact, Singer has this bad reputation of having always chosen young girls to work with him as the translator, and there are more than one rumor about the relationship that they had.
Connection listeners, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the money side of it, about the marketing side of it, and about what we gain and lose by not getting access to translations. And pose the question to you once again, is this country living in its own literary bubble? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Ilan Stavins, writer, translator, professor of Latin American and Latino cultures at Amherst College. We're talking about translation. It's a continuation of our New Writers, New Realities literature series here on The Connection. And we'll bring another guest into the conversation. Carol Janeway is a senior editor and vice president at Knopf. That's part of the Random House Publishing Company. And Carol's also director of international rights and a translator as well. Carol, you've had a chance to listen to Ilan and I speaking about translation.
Yes, I have.
Tell me, in your view, whether or not you think that American readers are missing out, that whether or not there is this sort of literary bubble in place.
Well, I think I'm much, much more optimistic, actually. No, I don't think America is in a bubble. I think in some ways part of this discussion, if you like, is a grandchild of H.L. Mencken and his portrait of America as the bourgeoisie. America, you can tell from my voice, I wasn't born in America, I'm a Scot. America has always seemed to me to be one of the most extraordinarily open and eclectic and welcoming cultures that one could imagine on Earth. I have been just enormously encouraged by the response of booksellers and readers to international literature. It's something I believe in passionately. It's something I dedicate a great deal of my life to. And I don't feel this bad about it. I really don't.
Well, pull the curtain back a bit for us, Carol. How does it work? If I'm a writer in Riyadh and I think that I have an Arabic text that might translate very well and sell very well in America, I mean, is it really hard for me to get your attention? Is it hard to make it through to the great big New York publishing heavies here?
Well, sure. The static is always, of course, very great. And for the individual writer to try to do that is very difficult unless writers know other writers within a network who can speak for them. Normally, the connections run between publishers. There are many things you can accuse publishers of, but the great characteristic of publishers is that we are all as curious as monkeys. It's part of what defines us. And so the moment we're listening to anyone who says, listen, I think I found this great thing, we are going to put down what we are doing and we are going to pay attention. So as in many things, it's semi-tribal for such a huge and now corporatized industry. It works by networks. It works by personal trust. It works by people knowing other people's taste and having watched them publish over time and simply knowing who to listen to and who to be fascinated by. So if you are an author in Riyadh, the first question is, who is publishing you within your own world? Now, the likelihood is at the moment that the connection from Riyadh to New York might not be so direct, but there might very well be a connection, for example, from Riyadh to Paris or Riyadh to Munich or another intermediary staging post. You won't necessarily jump from one world into the American world direct, but you may jump through other cultures that also translate a great deal and where your books will be found. I mean, for example, my own two working languages are French and German. And I will read absolutely everything I can in those two languages, not only by French and German writers, but as works from other countries come into French or German, it means I can read them in translation and get that immediate sense of my own response to a writer. Because the thing about publishing is it's not an academic exercise, it's a very personal exercise. And what you're looking for is that absolutely intuitive, back-of-the-neck response when you meet a writer's voice on the page.
Okay, but one more question on the commercial side of it. I assume you have found this, next great thing. Down the hall you go to the marketing department or the accountant and say, I found this next great thing. And at some point, someone's going to say, well, can she appear on Oprah? And you'll say, well, no, she doesn't speak English. Well, then the book tour is out. And I mean, aren't there things that are stacked against the author who's writing in another language simply on those at that level?
Well, first of all, of course, Oprah no longer has a book club, so we can take that one off the table. Second, I happen to have been the publisher of the only foreign author who ever did appear on Oprah and who spoke perfectly good English, and that was a miracle, so I was very happy about that. Well, of course, marketing has something to do with this, but there's a great kind of fiction out there about how the publishing world works, and along with the bugbear of corporations, there's a kind of myth that, well, it's marketing, well, it's sales, well, it's financial interference, there's always going to be a block. What publishing comes down to is the editor's enthusiasm combined with the editor's track record. If you believe in a book and you can make people listen to you and you have shown before that you were right more often than you were wrong, you are going to be able to get a very long way. And there are authors out there who are now selling over 100,000 copies, who don't speak a word of English, who've never been here on promotion, who can't do any of those things. I mean, take, for example, a little book which you may or may not be aware of, which is out there in the bookstores right now, called, of all unlikely titles, Balzac and the Little Chinese Seamstress. The author is Chinese. His name is Dai Cg. He writes in French because he lives in Paris. It is a novel we bought from a French publisher. Its sales are now up into the hundreds of thousands of copies. It is a book that booksellers are hand-selling all across the country because it is loved. It is being sold by word of mouth. This is not an exceptional tale. It happens more often than a certain kind of pessimistic cliché would like to think.
What do you think, Ilan?
I wish it was really a pattern more than an exception. I agree with Carol. This is a very generous, open country. It is also a very parochial country. How many novels from the Arabic were published just last year? I, for one, who spends hours literally in bookstores, couldn't find a single copy. Two, three altogether, being hopeful that the numbers are not as dismal as one would think. There is no one probably in New York City that reads Arabic, or if there is one, we are lucky for that person to convince his or her peers that a single novel should pass the test of the editorial board and be published. It will take a big effort. And in the end, what we'd have as a result of media, as a result of politicians, is a very simplified view of what the Arab world is all about. New York publishers cannot be blamed for this, but in many ways, by coming from Scotland or by coming from Latin America or by coming from France and from Germany, we are always confining ourselves to the same cultures rather than expanding our horizons. And in many ways, university presses have tried to cover this emptiness by suggesting that if a New York established a publishing house will not do a title, then perhaps we should do it. But then university presses have a different expectation. And the way their titles would reach a wider audience is much more limited. They will publish 2,000 copies rather than 20,000 copies. And if those 2,000 copies sell well, that will be a bestseller.
Let's open the conversation up and get some of our callers in. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. First to Beaufort, South Carolina, and Megan's joining us. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Hi, glad to be on the show. I listen all the time.
Great.
I was calling to say that I definitely feel there is a literary bubble, or more accurately, there's a whole cultural bubble. I mean, I taught myself to read Japanese so I can read the Japanese novels. I enjoy them a lot, but I mean, the whole stereotypes I run in with other kids, I mean, Nobody's willing to take that leap.
Megan, how old are you?
I'm 17.
And are you saying that you are looking at books in another language because you're not finding those stories in the library or in school or on the shelves?
It actually started with a television show for me that I got in the original Japanese with subtitles. I was horrified at how much they'd cut out in the English version.
Right.
So I decided I would teach myself Japanese so I could read the books that had preceded the show, you know, in their original versions. And I just fell in love, I guess.
One more question, Megan. Why do you think it is that there isn't a greater appetite for the types of books you're talking about?
I'm not sure, really. I mean, I personally learned another language, and I don't think very many other people are interested in investing that much time into something. But, I mean, I'm not fluent yet, but, and secondly, at least in the youth, I just don't think they really care. They don't care what's going on in the world. One of my friends said to me, nobody pays attention to politics, that none other of my friends do. They just don't seem to care about anything. Really?
Let me turn back to Carol Janeway. Carol, just the idea that, or what Megan's describing, that people don't care.
I think there may be some things which are very pertinent to say about the American educational system in junior school and high school. I think that, yes, the teaching of languages is lamentably neglected. And if you neglect language, then you automatically are neglecting other cultures. But, for example, in terms of Japanese literature, as it happens, my publishing house was the publishing house that first introduced Japanese literature to all of the West. It was one of Knopf's great traditions. Every single one of the great generation of Japanese writers was published by Knopf. The problem is that, in part, great writing seems to go, in to some extent, in natural cycles. We can't explain this, but it tends to happen. The great generation of Japanese writers has now pretty much come to its end. The finest writer writing now whom we publish is Haruki Murakami, who is extraordinary. The other writer who is published internationally, but on a very different level, is Banana Yashimoto. There is an enormous amount published in Japan that just isn't very good. We have advisors, you know, who follow all of this for us and who watch. And when you're looking for the really exceptional voices, you have to be able to filter out a lot of what is finally imitative or really not that original or just isn't going to last. Just as, for example, the Latin American boom, which had a vast impact on North American and English language culture in general, starting, of course, with Marquez, but magic realism and etc. Those writers, too, they are all of a maturity now. The younger writers coming along have not, on the whole, filled the same shoes. I'm lucky enough to be the publisher of Thomas Eloy Martinez, whom I think is wonderful. But the writers seem to be coming a little bit more from metropolitan Spain at the moment, for example, than they are from Latin America. You become, as an editor, accustomed to realizing that there are these kind of curved cycles in writing coming from different cultures. I think one of the single most interesting cultures at the moment happens to be Holland. There are absolutely wonderful writers coming out of Holland.
I just need to stop you for half a second there, Carol. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
I'm Ted O'Brien with Marianne Nichols on this, the last day of the fundraiser. They've just handed us a new number, and it's $57,000 to go by 8 o'clock tonight, but we can do that. We don't have much time left, but we need your commitment and your pledge at 1-800-909-9287.
That's right, 1-800-909-9287. Just remember, NPR has reporters stationed all over the world, places that commercial broadcasts have pulled out of. WBUR, I tell you, we do such a fabulous job here, Ted. I mean, just the amazing amount of intelligence and experience, the veteran reporters. This is what your money is paying for when you call 800-909-9287.
Well, we need your commitment now. If you haven't called yet during this year-end fundraiser, you should know there's just a few hours to go. Your pledge will make the difference. We can reach that goal. It's doable, but only if you help. So please call 1-800-909-9287, whether it's $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month. Put it on a credit card. We'll deduct it monthly, take care of all the paperwork for you, and you'll know that an uninterrupted flow of news and information will keep coming your way.
That's right. There's a direct relationship between your call to 800-909-9287 and the programming that we can give you here at WBUR. By the way, I'd like to thank a couple of people who called this morning for the very first time, Bruce Richardson of Lexington and Marcy Thomas of Medway. Thank you so much for your calls to 1-800-909-9287. Just a reminder, this is it. This is the last day of the WBUR fundraiser, and you can also pledge at WBUR.org.
But pledge, we need to hear from you. And, you know, a lot of the people who called this morning, well, here's an example of the kind of people that you're going to join with a call at 1-800-909-9287.
My name is Cindy Rush. I'm from AR, Massachusetts.
My name is Miles Rush, and I'm from Massachusetts, and I live in the same house as he does.
Now, you listen every day, and so does he, consequently, while we're getting ready for school. And finally this morning, he said, it's the last day. Aren't you going to pledge, Mom? Oh, the dog's chasing him. So, you know, anyway, I said, well, I already pledged. And he said, well, you know, that's not enough. You should pledge again. You listen every day. So I said, okay, we'll pledge again. I said, you can help me.
I like listening to WBUR. It's a nice news station, and I can hear the weather, and I guess I like listening to it. And I want to help pay for it, because I don't want it to go out of business.
So you've told me sometimes you even pick it up on your little radio Walkman, huh, Miles?
Yeah, my Pride radio. Whenever I'm sleeping, I turn that on and listen to it.
Yeah. actually, it was Miles' boombox that finally got me listening. For years, I tried to get my husband to tune in our stereo receiver to BUR. I couldn't get it in my car, and I couldn't get it on the receiver, and I never did get it until one day we tuned in on Miles's portable, and I said, great, I could get it on the portable. So that was sometime in last year, about 6 months ago. And
I like heard on the news that they want to make every dollar pledge, so I thought we should pledge something.
Yeah, now we listen every morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
What a great moment. I want to thank Cindy and Miles Rush for their support and for being willing to talk about it and let us share it with you, and also for their pledge at 1-800-909-9287 on this, the last day of the fundraiser. It is a real community of WBUR listeners and the folks that work here, and we want you to be a part of it too, with a call and a pledge at $5 a month, $10 a month, $20, whatever you can do. It's the last day of the fundraiser. We're in our last hours, and we need to hear from you at 1-800-909-9287.
That's right. $57,000 to go between now and the end of the fundraiser this evening. And if you've called in already, like Cindy and Miles, that was really adorable. Thank you so much for helping pay for this unique news service here on WBUR. If you haven't called yet, well, we're getting pretty much down to the wire. 1-800-909-9287. Use your credit card. Pledge a monthly amount. We want to make it comfortable for you. We want to...
Where else?
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Is this country living in some kind of literary bubble? Are there a whole bunch of books being written out there by people that aren't being translated that people in this country should be reading? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Ilan Stavins, writer, translator, prof of Latin American and Latino cultures at Amherst College, translates to and from Yiddish, Hebrew, and Spanish, and is a judge for the 2003 International Impact Literary Prize. We're going to go to San Francisco. David is listening online and joining us on the phone. Hi, David.
Hey, good morning. First of all, I'd like to mention it was kind of interesting you should have Knopf, because Knopf was once one of our great independent publishing house, and when they published something, people would look to it and they knew it would be something really good. Now they're in part of some multinational public multinational publishing monolith for sure. But what I'm wondering is whether the thirst to read is still here like it was. I think a lot of people used to read books like that now go to see the foreign film, and we have the Dogma School. We have a lot of conversation about foreign films, and we no longer have the kind of conversation about literature we once did. Elon Stavis is a guy who's pretty much alone with what he does. I read Elon. In fact, he's been on my radio show here. Hey, Elon. But I know he's very much of an individual for keeping up that banner of reading as an international and personal experience. I don't know if it's still there. And I wonder,
Elon, are you a lone crusader for this?
I hope not. I hope there are many more out there, and I'm sure there are, that are eager to find treasures in the world at large and bring them home.
But Elon, I read a lot. And I wish you'd met your book, which is a story of your account of living in Israel and living in Mexico and exploring literature with a real enthusiasm of your life, is pretty unusual. Mention your book. It's a really good one.
This is the memoir.
This is the memoir, On Borrowed Words. I wanted to go back to something that was mentioned before. There's a growing number of writers all over the world that have decided to forego the process of translation. You had one in your show not long ago. People that have decided that it's better to try their luck as writers in English or in French or in German because they will get more attention. It brings to mind something that a South African writer once told me. In order to be recognized at home in Johannesburg, he needed to be read in New York. Otherwise, nobody would pay attention to him. It is from New York that the news in South Africa about what matters there makes sense. We live in this kind of centripetal world. And if we don't expand our horizons here, other cultures also have consequences to that limitation.
1-800-423-8255. David, thanks for your call. We're going to Northampton, Massachusetts, and Moira's joining us. Hi, Moira.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I'm calling because I actually work for a small publisher, and we do almost nothing but works of translation, usually from Arabic. And
hey.
I do think the audience is out there. I think the problem is the big houses aren't taking the chances with these books. It's a slow and expensive process, and the small publishers aren't getting the attention that they need and that they deserve.
You say attention, you mean from radio programs like this one?
Yes. Radio programs from the media. I mean, you know, it's very New York based, and it's incredibly hard.
So, Moira, what aren't people reading? What are they missing?
Well, they're missing other points of views. They're missing. I think one of the problems with us as publishers of Arabic novels is very often people don't want to hear a different political review and point of view. And a lot of the Arabic novels, of course, do have that. We publish a lot of third world, not just Arabic, but third world translations, and very often by women in countries where women aren't heard from very often. So, you know, we're adopted in college classrooms all the time, but we can't get our books in bookstores.
Dick, hooray for small publishers. In Amherst, for literary small literary magazines. If a writer is not published by the New Yorker or by the Atlantic Monthly, that means that writer doesn't exist in this country. And it's the small publishers in the small literary magazines that do a great deal for us to remain, I will say, democratic. This is what it is all about, listening to other voices. If somebody in the Arab world dislikes us, is that reason enough for us not to pay attention to what he or she is saying? Absolutely not. We need to hear other voices, whatever the content of those voices is.
I'm wondering, as I listen to the two of you speak about this, though, whether or not people don't feel, rightly or wrongly, that they're hearing those voices, getting access to that now in the little snippets that they might see on the web, and ignoring the books for that reason.
If there's any medium that is democratic, it is the web. We do today in the web e-publishing, and that enables us to see other perspectives. But the web has its limitations. You don't have the experience of holding a book, of passing it to a friend, of underlining a page, of smelling it, of feeling that it's your friend. A book will always be a book, and it needs to remain that way. The web might give us access to information, but the experience of literature is the experience of beauty, the experience of transformation. And through translation, we will get that. The web will only get us so far.
Moira?
Yes, I agree entirely. Of course, I'm a book person.
That's
so,
all right.
And the physicality of it, and I do. I think the web is transient, and we forget about what we see on the web much more quickly than what we see on a page.
Moira, thanks a lot for calling in.
Thank you. Bye.
1-800-423-8255 to Wellesley now, and Michael's joining us. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I wanted to raise the issue of actually quality of translation and also presentation of translation by publishers. I'm a scholar of North African literature, Francophone and Arabophone, and I've taught courses in it. And very often you get a translation of a book, and much of what the very thing that you wanted to teach about that book has been completely lost in the translation. And I'm
like what? Can you be precise?
Yeah. Well, I can give you an example of a book called by a writer named Mohammed Shukri. in which two chapters have been removed from the book. There's two chapters in the book that are written in verse, and those two chapters just completely disappear.
Because they're so hard to translate?
I don't think so. I think it's, I'm not sure. The book is also, the original Arabic is also very complicated, introduces a lot of dialect, etc. But, and that's all been sort of translated into a very proper, very everyday sort of English.
Not as romantic, not as...
But it's a perfect thought. The translators are also censors. How often do we get this idea that a translation, in order to sell, has to improve or change the form or conform into the establishment so that people out there will buy it? And there's also something to be said about the transient element, the transient quality of translation. Listen, in Spanish we have a single Don Quixote of La Mancha, the one that Cervantes wrote. In English, we have 17 different translations from the 16th century to the present. 17. Why on earth would America or the English language world need 17? Well, because every generation approaches the text differently, and you needed the freshness, the crisp quality of the translation to bring it to that new reader that is waiting out there. And so the result is that you have the Elizabethan Don Quixote, and you have the Victorian, and you have the modern. And that makes it also a very stimulating effort. Every new generation will come forth and say, the previous translation is worthless. Let me show you what Madame Bovary is all about, or what Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment should be perceived, in what way. And in many ways, we're richer in translation than in the original. If we have 17 Don Quixotes in English, isn't that better than having a single one in Spanish?
Michael, do you agree with that?
Actually, I'm talking about something that's on a much more sort of shocking level than that. Translations that are often done with no cultural knowledge. For example, in Francophone North African literature, you often have scholars of French who translate North African novels and mistranslate cultural references. You even have footnotes that contain erroneous information. You have a very funny example I like to quote a lot is, there's a book where by a writer named Dries Schreby, where he talks about les magots, which is the French word for monkey, Barbary monkey, swinging from limb to limb, which comes out in English as the maggots swinging from limb to limb, because, you know, M-A-G-O-T is translated into M-A-G-G-O-T. So often, you know, it's more of a problem than this issue of interpretation, which is one I'm very sympathetic to, that different times, different places interpret the novel differently. I'm talking about sort of, and the novels are, they tend to be presented as glimpses inside the culture. We're going to go behind the veil of North African Islamic culture. And not a lot of attention is paid to the artistry of the artist who's writing the novel.
Michael, I want to thank you for calling in. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
I'm Trad O'Brien with Mary Ann Nichols, and right now we have fewer than 9 hours to come up with $56,000. That's right, $56,000, because folks just like you have been calling at 1-800-909-9287 to get that number down one pledge at a time. We can do it. It's doable, but only with your help. To pay not only for The Connection, but all the good programming, your dollar gets you a lot at 1-800-909-9287.
Yeah, last day of the fundraiser. We can do it. You can help us. Meeting the goal today gives us the time and the money to bring you the wonderful, in-depth, thought-provoking news and conversation and features you depend on here at WBUR. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call. But again, everything winds up tonight. $56,000 to go. Please help us chip away at that by calling 800-909-9287.
In the meantime, we want to thank Karen Stern of Walden and Kathleen Boyle of Wayland and Elizabeth Keene of Weston. They were some folks that called 1-800-909-9287 just today, the last day of the fundraiser, because they didn't want to be left out as our year draws to a close.
1-800-909-9287, or pledge on the web at WBUR.org. You can listen there as well. Coming up on Here and Now, officials in Yemen claim ownership and demand the return of a ship containing Scud missiles. They'll also be heading out to the United States, saying it'll use overwhelming force, including nuclear nuclear weapons in response to any chemical or biological attack. There's also a look at a book about the trauma soldiers face when they're coming home, a new book called Odysseus in America. Also a holiday food segment, the news magazine that has it all here and now. You can support that at 1-800-909-9287.
But it's the last day to get in your pledge. If you haven't called yet, your pledge will make a difference. Reaching that goal is doable. We want to raise every dollar there because we want to bring you uninterrupted the news and information you count on. We want to thank so many folks for calling just over this last week with so many different reasons for pledging. Here, for example, is some people that called just a little while ago.
I'm Catherine Kirchner. I live in Brookline, Massachusetts. Had you finally gotten to me, because I've been listening to this all the time, you know, nobody likes to hear the pledge drive, but hearing Susan Stamberg quote her mother saying, "What, don't be a freeloader," got to me, and I realized that I do deeply appreciate the ongoing news in depth, and I believe quite independent and objective news. And I listen to it morning to night, and one is on point. I find that very invigorating and really appreciate Tom Ashberg. I think he really does an excellent job. And I like Robin Young very much. I think that Here and Now has really become a very vital program also. I think you've expanded it, and it's really reaching out all around the world, and I really appreciate that program as well. I've contributed over the years, you know, but I feel people have to continue to contribute because it's just too valuable to have your voice being heard in these times.
Well, thank you, Catherine, for your thoughtful comment and for your pledge at 1-800-909-9287. As Catherine points out, there is a variety of programming on the air. She has her favorites, and they happen to be mine, too. Here and Now with Robin Young coming up in just a moment. Tom Ashbrook, On Point, Dick Gordon, The Connection. These are favorites, along with Morning Edition with Bob Oakes and All Things Considered with Gina Cervetti. Inside Out, our special in-depth investigative series, which has just won a national award. All of these are supported, but it's the last day for you to do that at 1-800-909-9287.
$56,000 to go. We got to get there tonight. 1-800-909-9287. If you've pledged already, thank you so much. And if you haven't picked up the phone yet, to call 800-909-9287. Help us out, because really, your pledge, every pledge to 800-909-9287 helps give us the time and the money to put the wonderful programming that you depend on 24/7. Again, 800-909-9287, or pledge on the web at wbur.org.
We don't have much time left, and we're asking you to do your part to give us the time and money that we need to keep bringing you the news and information that you've come to count on. Elizabeth George of Worcester did, and Melanie Rodriguez of Lawrence found the time to make the call at 1-800-909-9287. Please join them with $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month. Put it on a credit card. We'll see to the paperwork and the monthly deduction.